Reminder to everybody, 34 minutes total of argument. First 2 minutes will be uninterrupted. How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I would like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal, Chief Justice.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. McCletchie, you can go ahead.
I'm ready. Maggie McCletchie for the Access Coalition. Today, there are two key questions before the court. The first and most important question is whether the district court unconstitutionally closed first the entire case, disappearing it entirely from the public record, and second, in keeping almost the entire case closed and including keeping proceedings, both past and future, entirely closed. The answer to this question is yes. This is true under any analysis, but strict scrutiny does apply. To avoid the inevitable result that the logic and the experience test supports finding, the probate court is not the rare exception to the rule that all civil proceedings are public. Does and the district court rely on the purported exceptional nature of both probate court and of the litigants. Both aspects fail. The logic prong, according to case law, is the most important prong, and alone, if it supports access, can support finding that the First Amendment applies. Here, logic supports access. The beneficial effects that courts' analyses rely on do not apply with less force here. In probate court, there are pro se litigants, for example. Further, public oversight is no less important. It's important in all matters. We have elected judges, for example, as this court talked about in Falcone. Rather than supporting the type of categorical denial of access that occurred here, the role of wealthy and important litigants, in fact, supports finding access. And that's because of the importance of fairness, avoiding corruption, and facilitating public trust, including in the equal application of the law that public access advances. The district court relied on the very public interest in access to deny access. Courts can't do that. That's entirely circular. Yes, Justice Stiglitz.
I waited till 1459.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Quick question. Did the petitioners challenge the constitutionality of these statutes below?
No, Your Honor. And I'd be happy to address the statutes. So if the district court and the Does are right about how they interpret the statute, yes, the statutes are unconstitutional. But it is the Access Coalition's position that that unconstitutional result can be avoided, which is what courts should do. Rather than giving litigants an absolute right to privacy that district court judges must follow, these statutes are essentially ministerial. And if I may walk through them, NRS 669A, which is the statute that governs family trust matters, first just says that a litigant may petition the court to seek sealing. It doesn't say that the district court must follow that determination. The statute that governs requests for closure does not even mention confidential information, which is separately defined by the statute, but is discussed in 669A.310, which governs the information held by the government by the commissioner that oversees family trust. So nothing in 669A or anywhere else in Chapter 669 A says that litigants have an absolute right to privacy.
Ms. McCletchie, if this court were to uphold the statute, did the district court, you believe, operate within the confines of the statute?
The district court did not. The district court applied the statute so broadly that it essentially said that there was no guesswork, that the parties had the right to confidentiality, which actually appears not only nowhere in 669A, but it also doesn't appear in NRS 164. I think the right way to read NRS 164.041, the sealing statutes, is that subsection 1 essentially provides for provisional sealing, that a party can initiate sealing and file them under seal prior to a court order. It doesn't say that there shouldn't be an effort sought to get a court order. Here, while I can't read the order, there is an order, in fact, in January of 2024. Second, subsection 2 just says unless the court orders otherwise, parties can't turn around and refile the information that another party has filed under seal, essentially. And subsection 3 If the Does are right that the public can't seek access under that section, in fact, what that section really says upon closer review is that even if the district court enters an order sealing that information, even if it's secret, then the court still can provide that information to other people upon good cause. And so that means that even if the district court says, this meets the test, this meets the constitutional test, and it should be secret, that doesn't stop the court from giving an interested party or another member of the public that establishes good cause access to records. But nothing in the statute...
Could you return to 164041 subparent 1?
Mm-hmm.
Because what reading would you give that avoids constitutional infirmity?
That it says prior to court order that the information may be sealed. The way that I read that is that it addresses the tricky situation of until the court enters an order, information isn't sealed. So in my view, one allows for provisional sealing while you await a court order. The statute's
explicit. And you think that is constitutional?
I think that you can that initially you file a motion to seal and you're asking the court for permission to seal it, that with that you may submit those documents to the court provisionally under seal. But the ultimate determination under Falcone, you can't interpret the statutes in a manner that says it's up to the litigant. And while the district court gave some space to the idea of public access, essentially it did find that the litigants had a right to access and that it had to follow their requests for access.
So if we follow this statute, Ms. McCletchie, in subparagraph 3, there has to be good cause or cause shown. What are the competing interests at play here? What is the need for the access? And then what are the compelling interests to deny that access?
Well, so that statute, I think, should be interpreted consistently with the constitutional right of access. And that, to be clear, that does not require the party seeking access to establish the need for access. There's a presumptive right of access. To me, that subsection, Justice Lee, simply provides that even if a record retains its confidential nature in court, an interested party, for example, that needs it for some other reason, can get access. So here, there's a presumptive right of access. I began addressing the logic aspect of the test, and under that test, the logic test necessarily supports finding access here. There is no reason to find that probate court matters or family trust matters are an exception to the rule, and the reasons that support finding access apply with more force, frankly, when the litigants are important. Here, both the Does and the district court said that there was no public interest in access, essentially. In fact, not only is there a public interest in all court proceedings, presumptively, because, for example, as discussed in Falcone, judges are elected. There's a particular public interest here because of the role of the Murdochs and their prominence in the national political and media landscape. That was used by the district court as a reason to deny access, which I think is turning it on its head. With regard to the experience test that determines whether the First Amendment right applies, the Does rely entirely on archaic examples. They ignore that in El Vocero and in Falcone, this court rejected the idea that archaic English law necessarily governs and is dispositive. Instead, El Vocero talks about the national landscape. This is an ordinary civil proceeding. There might be some differences. It's a species of civil proceedings. But in a similar case, Delaware Open Government v. Stein cited in our reply, the court explained the proceedings in front of judges and courthouses have been presumptively open to the public for centuries. In that case, the court found that secret arbitrations could not be conducted in court and found that the presumptive right of access applied, even though those were a little bit different than typical civil proceedings.
Ms. McCletchie, can I jump in? A quick question, differentiating between the access to the courtroom and the records. Is it within the legislative purview to identify certain classes of documents or records that are typically filed as confidential? Is that within the legislative purview?
The legislature can give guidance about what kind of information can be confidential. Here, but the legislature cannot circumvent the First Amendment right of access by declaring information confidential, and district courts can't then apply those confidentiality statutes so broadly that they exempt, that they effectively take entire proceedings out of the public view. But here, I think when we look at the statutes, while the district court believed that and contended that these statutes created a right of privacy, it was nothing like, the language is nothing like a privilege statute. There is certain confidential information that it includes, but for example, in 669A, in the sealing provision of that statute, it doesn't say all confidential information must be sealed. And there is no absolute confidentiality. There are always reasons why a claim of confidentiality can be, in certain circumstances, overcome. But there is no express declaration of total confidentiality over any specific records, any specific information, let alone proceedings in these chapters.
So, Ms. McCletchy, so given that the court here, unlike in the Falcone case, the court did discuss privacy interests and discuss public interest and did some sort of a weighing as part of the court's order. So isn't that enough? And why is that an abuse of discretion?
Well, the court gave some lip service to the idea that there was an interest in public access in all civil proceedings, and it referenced NRS 155.130, which makes clear that probate proceedings are a matter are proceedings of record, yet it found that it could entirely erase this case from public view, which I think necessarily means that it did not engage in the proper balancing. And what it said is that the parties had a right to privacy and confidentiality under the statutes, and because everything in the case related to the matters that it saw as confidential under the statutes, it had to seal the entire case. So I don't think that the district court really did balance the interests. Further, the district court didn't go through specific information. It just says the entire record is filled with this confidential information. It didn't go through the kind of specific analysis that is procedurally required under the First Amendment analysis. And it's logic that the parties have a right to privacy under the information, and confidential information in probate court and family trust matters is that the matters are so full of confidential information that they can be removed from public view isn't balancing the interest. It's not consistent with Falcone, because the district court essentially said that its arms were tied. While it talked about security, for example, it didn't point to any specific information as to why security meant that the entire record could be sealed. The security needs of the Murdochs aren't tied to these proceedings. The district court didn't explain that these proceedings cause particular security interests. In criminal cases, you have confidential informants testifying against defendants, and courts are able to address security. Courts are able to balance interests. The district court just said security is important here. It turned the presumption in favor of access on its head, and case law has explicitly rejected the approach that the district court took when wealthy and important litigants are involved, and has said that those arguments don't support wholesale secrecy. For example, in the Mueller v. Swift case and in the Hearst case that we cited, of course, we're not arguing that all cases are forever open and no information can be sealed. That is not the petitioner's position. It's the Does and the district court that take the extreme position that secrecy is necessarily completely warranted. Instead, the argument is just that this case should be treated just like other information that district courts handle all the time. Any interest in specific financial information or private information can be considered by the district court just because this is a family trust matter or just because the litigants are wealthy and important is not a basis to close proceedings. In the Delaware Open Government v. Stein case, that court rejected the very argument that the Does make here, that Delaware was trying to attract litigants and we need secrecy in arbitrations because of that. That's not an argument in favor of secrecy, and it doesn't trump the First Amendment. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
I'm going to give you an extra minute, but I have a question as well. The district court seemed to think that because the Supreme Court rules don't cover Title 13 cases, it had no ability to consider redaction. Agree, disagree, how could that, assuming these are constitutional and the legislature, the statutes, does have the ability to identify certain things, should the district court have the ability to redact?
Yes, the district court should have the ability to redact. One of the, I think 669A talks about sealing instead of redacting. The Does and the district court tried to argue that the statute into unconstitutionality by saying sealing is necessary, and the district court can't redact information. And with all due respect to the court, Chief Justice Herndon, this court doesn't govern the First Amendment test. That's governed by First Amendment case law. And so, frankly, it's irrelevant if the Supreme Court sealing rules don't address probate matters.
Okay. Thank you. All right. We'll give Ms. McCletchie an extra minute for a rebuttal and add a minute to the time response.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Jordan Smith on behalf of Doe 9. With me today is my co-counsel, Alex Levesque. I'm arguing on behalf of Doe 9 today. The positions of Does 1 and Does 3 through 8 are set out in the papers of Ms. Rafferty and Ms. Dove. They've graciously let me argue this afternoon. And with that, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Since pre-founding English common law, equitable proceedings like those involving trusts have been conducted under seal. That's not an exception, that's the default. And although that may sound strange to our modern ears, there were sound logical reasons for doing so. As early American jurists like Chancellor Kent explained, quote, there's a very grave danger of abuse from public examinations, end quote. Petitioners have no contradictory history or countervailing logic that is unique to trust proceedings. As a result, they flunk the experience and logic test, and the First Amendment presumption of access does not apply to trust proceedings. Because the constitutional presumption does not apply, the legislature retains plenary authority to legislate the scope of access. And that's exactly what they've done in chapters 164 and 669A. The legislature furthered the state's interest of attracting trust business to Nevada and designated broad categories of information as confidential relating to trusts. The legislature provided a mechanism for access to parties, but placed the burden on the parties seeking access to show cause. The lower court applied these statutes exactly as written and did not manifestly abuse its discretion when it found that these particular petitioners did not show the requisite statutory cause. These statutes are not a privilege for the wealthy or famous. Anybody in Nevada with a trust proceeding may invoke them, whether they have counsel or drafted their trust with LegalZoom. But adopting petitioners' arguments here would have far-reaching consequences, and you just heard it. That would include calling into question some of this court's rules, the grand jury, or statutes that presumptively seal things like criminal records.
Counsel, so I think we're in our 2 minutes now. So let's assume for a moment that the logic and experience test, we find that that does put us into constitutional land. I didn't see the district court do any type of analysis under Press Enterprise that we adopted in Falcone, but can you walk me through those factors, the three factors that were articulated in that case that you have to show, so the burden would be on your client, not on the other party, not the coalition, to show that the closure serves a compelling interest. What is that compelling interest? Number two, there's a substantial probability that in the absence of closure, the compelling interest could be harmed. And finally, that there's no other alternatives to closure that would adequately protect the compelling interest, applying it narrowly. So can you walk me through that analysis in terms of your client?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'd point Your Honor's attention to pages 207 of the record and 212 of the record. Those are portions of the district court's order where he does say compelling privacy interests. So he does reference, although he didn't specifically discuss those factors with the site, he does say compelling privacy interests. And the record's replete with those compelling interests, including physical safety, financial safety. The district court made specific.
But are those are general, kind of speculative type of harm. Have there been, so that, for instance, in the Hearst case, the harm was pretty apparent. Patty Hearst was infamously kidnapped, and then they were getting bomb threats and things of that nature. But here it just seems like it's more of a speculative kind of idea that they could have some harm or some fraud or some type of things. But there's been no real evidence that I could see in the record.
I think the probate commissioner was applying those factors specifically to these clients. I don't think he was identifying just general harms that wealthy people or famous people might have. He was applying it directly to these particular individuals. I'd point the court to page 74 of the record, where there was some discussion about a case of mistaken identity that led to a kidnapping.
That was 54 years ago.
It's still evidence related to this family, Your Honor, and unique to this family, not general concerns about wealthy people or individuals.
So 100 years from now, anyone in part of that family can also have every court proceeding closed because of that?
I don't know that there's a time limitation on kidnapping and murders, Your Honor, and when that stops being relevant. I mean, at some point, certainly, but we're talking about the high-profile nature of a family and the risk that this particular family is subject to. They require around-the-clock security. That's another individualized finding that this court made, not against wealthy people generally, but this family requires around-the-clock security. They had these things in their family history that give them a unique physical and security risk that other wealthy individuals don't face. But I don't think we even need to get to that point, because I think there's ample indications that the First Amendment, under the experience and logic test, the First Amendment presumption doesn't apply. We start with history, and my friends on the other side have zero history.
How does that history that you're arguing square with what we already concluded in Falcone the other way, while the dissenters in that case argued about some of that history, the majority rejected that argument. So how is this distinguishable?
I don't read Falcone that way, Your Honor. I read Falcone doing two things. First, Falcone makes the novel statement that the presumptive right of access can apply in a civil case. The U.S. Supreme Court has never said that, but this court said that in Falcone.
That doesn't make it novel.
Well, other circuit courts have said it, but it's novel for this court. This court hadn't said that despite having Stevens Media.
Yes.
So novel in Nevada. And then what this court did after imparting that statement about general civil cases, it then employed the experience and logic test to look at family law cases. So I don't read Falcone as saying, because the history and logic of family law cases indicates a presumptive right of access, that all future civil cases, no matter their type, would be subject to it. If that is what the court said in Falcone, it seems to clash a little bit with U.S. Supreme Court precedent, which requires the court to consider the experience and logic test with the precise type or kind of proceeding. That's what El Vocero said pretty clearly. So it's not just, is it civil?
Was the history you're relying on specific to trust cases as distinguished from family cases and other equitable proceedings?
That's correct, Your Honor. We're relying on the history of equity, and equity having a long history of being under seal.
Is it specific to trust cases or to all equity cases?
I acknowledge neither side cites a specific example of a trust case, but that's a strike against petitioners. That's not a strike against me. The history and logic test requires the petitioner to show a history. I think the phrase from page 573 of Richmond newspapers, an unbroken, uncontradicted history of public access. That burden's on the petitioners. There's no presumption that the presumption of access applies. It's their obligation to show you that throughout history, this type of proceeding.
So if the history that you're relying on is generally regarding equitable proceedings, how is that different than the family law proceedings we considered in Falcone?
Because it's even narrower. Family law encompasses as child custody cases, divorce cases.
But is their history not in equity?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Is the history of those family court cases also equitable proceedings like trust cases?
I think there might be some background there. I think the dissent talks about ecclesiastical cases, which if you look at the Professor Kessler's Law Review article, were a close cousin. But at equity, all types of equity cases were conducted under seal. So those cases didn't differentiate between trust cases or other cases that might be subject to equitable jurisdiction. But the procedure was, it was well accepted. Everything was behind closed doors, conducted even in an ex parte fashion. So the other parties didn't see the evidence until publication. Publication didn't mean publication to the world. Publication meant to the other parties.
But you're proceeding, at least from what is put forward in the reply, when the decision comes out and it's reported, it shows that the equitable historical model that you're invoking wasn't followed at all in this case. The witnesses were called, they were cross-examined, they were challenged with one another's proof. And the decision, as referenced, didn't it seemed to concern a fight over power and control that would be outside the parameters of something that should be categorically sealed. What do you say to that, that the equitable proceeding that you're invoking is now extinct?
I think the proceeding as it happened here looks a lot like, to me, what happened at courts of equity. And I would point at, again, Professor Kessler's Law Review article, which explained how it worked. You had written interrogatories delivered to a master or commissioner, the precursor to a probate commissioner. Those would then either be delivered orally. Later on, toward the beginning of the 19th century, there was even cross-examination by the parties, all conducted under seal. So there was examination in the 19th century, before more modern times, in equitable proceedings, and that cross-examination still remained under seal. The Remsen versus Remsen decision by Chancellor Kent, the Justice Story case, Gass, explains all that, how there even was cross-examination and testimony, but it remained under seal even in courts of equity. And my friends on their side, that's what they have. They have no evidence at historical evidence that trust cases weren't covered. So we can quibble around the edges about equitable cases, but again, it's their burden to show that there was an unbroken, uncontradicted history of open access to trust proceedings, and they don't have anything before 1977 and the Hearst case. We can say a lot about the 70s, but it doesn't tell us much about the original public understanding of the First Amendment. And that continued in the American colonies, again, through the 19th century into the early 20th century. And there was logic for doing so. There was concerns about open testimony leading to fabrication of evidence and other influences negatively in the truth-finding process. And I think that's partially what motivated this court in its own rules, exempting trust proceedings from the rule against closing civil proceedings entirely, or preference for redaction, Justice Herndon. This court's rules exempted trust proceedings from that, and it had reasons to do so. Trust proceedings are unique, and they raise different concerns compared to other types of cases. The logic, my friends...
What are the different concerns in a trust case as opposed to a family case or a corporate dispute or any other kind of case?
I think trust cases incorporate all the sensitive aspects of family cases and trust cases. Trust cases, you deal with all the dynamics about siblings, children, family relations. Then you layer on top of that the commercial cases with detailed financial information, business interests, and you layer on top of those things concerns about legacy, death, inheritance. Those things render the trust proceedings at least exacerbating those concerns that we have for commercial cases and family law cases. My friends on the other side don't have any particular logic about this type of case that requires it to be open.
What about ensuring fairness in the proceedings and ensuring that wealth and power don't influence the proceedings? I mean, the Murdoch's trust assets includes Fox and News Corporation, which is a publicly traded company. So the public, I think, really does have a vested interest in what's going on in this case, just like any other civil proceeding. So what about that countervailing public interest?
The notoriety or wealth of the parties plays no part in determining whether the First Amendment right exists in the first place. All those factors might play a role if you find that the First Amendment applies and then you do the compelling interest standards, then we get into it. But if we're talking...
Right, that's what I want to get into. Like, I want to just get into that part of it because I understand what your logic and experience arguments are, but let's pretend that we are in First Amendment land, and how do you get over the presumption of access in this instance?
The district court made findings and determined that the interest that the petitioners advanced was just sheer curiosity. And that's not enough. Sheer curiosity isn't the overwhelming public interest. The district court read the papers, made factual findings that are entitled to deference at this stage, and he determined that all they demonstrated was sheer curiosity. And he determined that was a de minimis public interest that didn't outweigh the rest. And in the context of a writ petition, when we're talking about a manifest abuse of discretion, I don't think we can say that was clearly wrong in order to reverse.
Well, I think there was also some discussions about ensuring fairness in the proceedings, right? This is why we open up these proceedings to the public, is to ensure that they're fair, that one side's not getting a better deal than the other because of who they are, or that the judge is doing a good job in mediating these disputes. So what about that? What about that interest?
The legislature also plays a role in balancing those types of interests. I mean, they also are public servants. The courts also play a role, but it's a conversation between the judiciary and the legislature. And the legislature here, through these statutes, has struck a balance it determined was the appropriate one, weighing fairness, public access, and public interest. So I think we need to give some credence to the legislative balance as well. It's not solely an issue for the courts. And again, I would rely on the fact that the probate commissioner determined the interests advanced here were just sheer curiosity, that it was the petitioner's burden to show something more, and they didn't.
And going to the legislative piece of this with NRS 164-041, do you think that that statute is constitutional, or does it kind of impermissibly shift the burden onto the person seeking to unseal documents as opposed to applying a presumption of openness?
And are we in First Amendment land when I'm answering this, Your Honor, or am I talking from first principles?
Well, you can address it both ways.
Okay, I'll start with first principles. It is constitutional because I don't think the First Amendment presumption of access applies. Mm-hmm. If the First Amendment presumption of access doesn't apply, the legislature can strike whatever balance it wants to. If we do end up in First Amendment land, as Your Honor is suggesting, I still think it's constitutional because it's very different than the statute struck down in Falcone. Falcone was blanket sealing. Here, 164 at least has categories that things have to fit into that Falcone didn't have. And the documents here under 164 have to be submitted to the court in camera, and a party can seek access. So I think it's constitutional either way. But make no mistake, I think this is just...
Is there anything in this case that doesn't come within the categories under one of these two statutes?
According to the
court said no, right?
Court said no. Court said
Did
no.
Do you agree?
I do agree. The court sitting at the front row.
So then is there any difference? Like the fact that they made a list that encompasses everything in the case, I guess, it uses different words than saying everything's sealed. But as a practical matter, there's no difference.
I'll take the statutes one at a time and I'll show you the difference. In 164, a party does get to file it on its own under seal, but there's categories it has to fit into. Under 669, the party has to seek leave of court. The court may deny it. And then I understand the 169 categories are pretty broad. 1G and H cover pleadings and orders. I understand that. But under that statute, a party has to petition, and a court can always deny it. And under both, parties have leave to seek, have the ability to show cause to gain access. I think those two statutes are very different than the ones at issue in Falcone. And make no mistake, the petitioners are challenging the constitutionality of this. They try to disclaim it below and say that you should construe them in harmony with each other. There's no way to do that. Both statutes put the burden on the party seeking access. The First Amendment presumption puts the burden on the party trying to seal. You can't blue pencil these statutes and to render them consistent. So make no mistake, they are asking you to declare these statutes unconstitutional. They made the strategic decision not to say that because they know that's a heavy lift, but that's ultimately the end result here if petitioners are correct. There is one final point here I want to address with the last remaining minute here. There's another obstacle to writ relief here. The petitioners did have a plain, speedy, and adequate legal remedy in the ordinary course of law here, which would normally preclude writ relief. Their access motion was denied. The Washoe County court rules allow a party to seek judicial review of that. They did not do so. That was a plain, speedy, and adequate legal remedy. It was certainly faster than this writ petition. And I'm confident that if a person went directly from a discovery commissioner to this court and didn't object, I'm confident this court would say
there was a district court order in between there.
A district court order contemplating continued judicial review. There was the immediate enforcement and said it's going to be immediately enforced because the trial is ongoing, but enforced pending petition for judicial review. So even that order contemplated further proceedings, and so the parties had a plain, speedy, and adequate legal remedy that they failed to pursue. That should preclude writ relief. Unless there's any other questions, we ask that the petition be denied.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
First, Falcone's not unique. Del Papa discussed the right of access in judicial proceedings. The great weight of authority going back to the footnote in Richmond newspapers recognizes that all species of civil proceedings are presumptively open under the First Amendment. The Does rely on only archaic history, which is not what the test is. It's experience, not archaic history. El Vocero talks about the fact that it's the national landscape. This court rejected the idea that only archaic history can support secrecy in the Falcone case. We cite many cases. We cite other jurisdictions like Wisconsin, the Hearst case, and many cases in our reply too, where federal courts have presumed that probate court is open to the public and rejected the idea that because litigants are wealthy or powerful, that they are entitled to secrecy. On that note, any interest that the Murdoch have, any need for security, is entirely unrelated to this case. And this goes to the fact that the district court did not apply the balancing test. Not only did it say that the party has a right to invoke a statutory right to make the information sealed, which necessarily precluded it from ordering openness, it also did not explain how the information in the case, the specific information in the case, if it was released, why that information would pose a security interest. The issue isn't just that the litigants face security concerns. They get secrecy in civil court. That's just not the case. The Doe's argument would lead to bizarre results. Even the parties and their counsel, for example, if we were going to follow equitable rules, could have been excluded from the questioning. Grand juries are different because they're investigatory. And notably, even when an indictment is had, the transcripts of the grand jury proceedings are public. We don't have the transcripts of the grand jury, of the proceedings in this case. They're still secret. Even our pleadings are still not in the public record, at least the last time I looked. Even the January 24th order addressing whether the case should be sealed is still...
Ms. McCletchie, is this just sheer curiosity, as counsel has argued, and apparently the court held?
Absolutely not. First of all, the public has a serious and important interest in all court proceedings. Courts belong to the people. These are democratic principles. We have elected judges, and these cases implicate serious public interest with regard to the specific role of the Murdochs. On the one hand, the Does argue that the fact that it's the Murdochs means they're private, and then on the other, try to ignore the public importance of this case and the impact of this case. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, and I should have said this from the beginning, and I apologize, but you all know by the order that we issued on Monday that Senior Justice Hardesty was appointed to participate in the case in the absence of Justice Bell. He's listening to the arguments and will be part of the deliberations, but wasn't able to be here today.
Thank you. And just to be clear, the Access Coalition has no objection to his participation. Okay. Thank you.
Great briefing, terrific arguments. Appreciate all of you and all your work on this. And the